Welcome to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend.
So Tim, in our journey to explore family law issues on this podcast, today we're going to have a talk about some, you know, relatively common but really controversial issues regarding relocation and international relocation.
I'm excited.
I'm really excited too, because they're kind of the most vexing cases that you have in a parenting matter. Some really big decisions either have to be made by the parents or by the judge if it goes to trial. So today we're joined by the Honourable Colin Forrest. Hi, Colin.
G'day. How are you going, Gillian? Tim?
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Lovely to be with you today.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you. And I mean, we're all in, you know, speaking of relocation, we're all in kind of different spots. I mean, Tim's in Canberra, you're up in Brisbane, and I'm in Newcastle. But with the wonders of technology, we can have this discussion today.
Are you still locked down in Newcastle?
We are. And okay. I didn't see the news today, but allegedly we come out of lockdown on Friday, but I'm pretty skeptical that that's actually going to occur.
So I'm the only lucky one of the three of us. I can actually, after this, I can go outside and go up to the cafe up the road and have a coffee or a drink or something.
You can't. I'm shaking my head, but you can't see that on a podcast.
Well, that's true.
Brisbane people certainly feel for you, and we hope you come through it as soon as you can.
Yeah, thanks, Colin. So in terms of getting started, Tim, I'm going to give you a bit of background about Colin. So Colin graduated from the University of New South Wales in 1986 with degrees in arts and law, which is great. That's what I did too, Colin, so well done. Colin worked as a legal associate to Justice Michael Kirby, which
that's
is
very impressive.
The then president of the New South Wales Court of Appeal. In 1988, Colin spent 2 years working as an employed solicitor, and then in 1990 was called to the Queensland Bar, where he established a practice specialising in family law and succession law. Between 2011 and 2021, Colin was a judge in the trial division of the Family Court of Australia based in the Brisbane Registry. And in that time, he was the case management judge of the Brisbane Registry and a member of the Chief Justice's Policy Advisory Committee and as the Family Court's representative on the Combined Federal Courts Children's Committee. We might talk to you about combining courts in this podcast today. In his time at the court, Colin published over 500 written judgments.
500.
That's a stat that Tim put in there. So, Colin, you'll have to confirm that.
No, that's true. I did, yes.
That's amazing. And on occasion, he like also sat with the appeal division of the full court of the family court. So, and now, Colin, you're working as at the bar and also as a mediator and an arbitrator. So, it's very exciting to have you here today.
I have the first question for you, Colin.
Yes.
What haven't you done?
Oh, well, let me think. There's lots I haven't done. I haven't sailed around the world.
Wow.
No, I'd love
500
to.
500 judgments too. That's about 41 judgments a year. Are you tired?
Well, that's why I'm no longer a judge, I suppose.
Yeah, it's astonishing.
Fair to say that it did wear me down a bit.
Yeah, and no doubt.
I mean, that comes back to the topical issue at the moment of our courts merger last week.
Yes.
And you may have seen in the central practice direction, there's this discussion about the fact that we will have trials, you know, we'll get to the trial process and potentially a decision within a 12-month period. So I'm really keen to know from your perspective, because we're placing bets on it, how long do you think that's actually going to last for, and do you think that's achievable with the new processes that have been set in place?
Well, the best thing for me to say in response to that is that it's a worthy ambition.
That's a good answer.
It'd be fantastic if people who file their applications tomorrow could have their matters finally heard and determined before this time next year. And, you know, full credit to the court and its leadership for having that goal and ambition. And I wish them all the best, and hopefully it'll be able to be achieved. It's a big ask given the number of cases that are still in the pipeline that are waiting for trial. For example, at the what was called the winter callover in the Federal Circuit Court.
The winter of discontent.
The winter callover, which happened a couple of weeks ago, in Brisbane alone, there were 1,800 matters.
Oh, my goodness.
Listed to be or called through. And so every single one of those, at the time it was listed to be called through, was still a matter waiting for trial. So, you know, if I don't know how many of those were able to be successfully resolved pursuant to that callover process. The intention was to try and see if any of them were resolved or help them get resolved, send them to alternative dispute resolution through mediation and arbitration. I have no current knowledge of the stats of how many of that 1,800 that were called over actually were dispensed with, finally determined in some way. So they would have needed a lot of those to be finalised for the 12-month goal for matters that are filed from now on to be met. So good luck to them. The big difference is that that might help. Is that like only a couple of days before the merger commenced on the 1st of September, the court announced the appointment of something like 45 new registrars around the country, and that's on top of a whole bunch of new registrars that have been appointed over the last 18 months or so. So interestingly, effectively, the new court has adopted in Division 2, which was the Federal Circuit Court, the process that the family court had already been using and was always using, which was a greater triage, a use of registrars in the triage of matters between filing and ultimately putting them into a judge's docket and setting them down for trial in front of a judge. The FCC always worked on the basis that as soon as a matter was filed, it went straight into a judge's docket, it went straight to a judge on first return date, and the judge managed it right through to trial. The registrars will be doing most of that pre-trial management now and triaging, which is what's always happened in the family court. And hopefully that triaging will result in a lot more matters in Division 2 being resolved at an earlier stage than they otherwise would be, and not burdening the judge with having to hear and determine them.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I always try and, like in practice, I was trying to talk to clients about the fact that lots of matters, you know, will resolve along the pathway of a litigation process, and only, you know, very few matters require a final determination. But in terms of the things that we're talking about today with relocation, it's kind of one of those, you know, areas of, you know, cases and litigation where, you know, it has probably a higher probability of going to trial because, you know, there's three options really. Parent one makes a really tough decision and agrees to let, you know, the other parent go. Parent two says, okay, I'm not going to go and, you know, we'll just keep doing what we're doing. Or, you know, you go to a trial and have a judge make that decision for you. So in terms of, I guess, those kinds of cases, how commonly do you think they're the kinds of parenting cases that go to trial?
Yeah, well, I could tell you that as a judge at the family court in Brisbane, we were constantly reminded that of the filings that were filed in the Brisbane registry of the two courts, 90% of the filings went into the Federal Circuit Court, and only 10% of the filings came to the family court. So they were dealing with 90% of the filings. Some of those 90% that the Federal Circuit Court were getting initially would, of course, be transferred up to the family court pursuant to the protocol. But and the protocol, of course, naturally set out the sorts of cases that were meant to be heard by the family court.
And international complexity.
Yeah, international relocation cases, complexity, cases that were going to take more than 4 days of hearing time. Hague Convention matters, special medical procedure cases, those sorts of things when you're talking about parenting, not including anything about property. So you might already appreciate, as I certainly came to appreciate in my 10 years on the bench, as a family court judge, most of the work in the Brisbane Registry that I was doing, at least, and I believe my colleagues too on the family court were doing, most of the things we were doing were very difficult parenting cases.
Yeah.
Very difficult parenting cases, complex, difficult ones involving allegations of sexual abuse, physical abuse, international relocation, and many of them involving parties, I respectfully say, with very difficult personality issues, that necessarily made the cases longer. One of the real difficulties too was that, at least 40% of the cases that we were hearing, and have still been over the last 4 or 5 years in the family court, and I think if you look at the annual family reports, they'll show that over the last 4 or 5 years, it consistently around 43-44% of all matters that go to trial have at least one party unrepresented, and about 22% of cases that go to trial, somewhere around the 20-22%, have both parties unrepresented.
Yeah, wow.
And
because that would add to trial time as well. Like you think about Johnson and Johnson, REF, and all the considerations the court has to go through with dealing with self-represented litigants. It's a big task.
That statistic will change a lot now because of the change in the legislation where a person who has an assault conviction or where there's a family violence order in place, they have to have legal representation.
102A, of course.
Yeah, 112. So that stat will change over the next few years, but it was one of the things that made my job as a family lawyer incredibly difficult and the cases incredibly hard to decide. And you would also appreciate as family lawyers, any family lawyer listening to this will appreciate it, that where you have one or both parties unrepresented by a competent family lawyer, there's much less likelihood of the matter resolving before it gets to trial.
And that's a shame, I think. I think, I've often said that we as lawyers, our job primarily is to provide solutions to problems.
Yeah. The other thing about international relocation cases, of course, is they're not easily resolved because of the completely polarized interests of the parents. And, it's perfectly understandable in most international relocation cases, it's perfectly understandable that one party wants to relocate either back to the country they came from or to another country where their new partner might be from or wanting, and it's perfectly understandable that the other party who's staying behind in Australia doesn't want the child or children to leave. So they're really difficult cases to decide.
And in terms of, I guess, deciding cases like that, because, they're another form of parenting case, but what kind of information is really useful in being able to make determinations around best interests in international relocation cases? And I know that's a super broad question, but what kind of evidence is, really important and helpful to be able to adduce on behalf of your clients?
Gillian, I've always said it when I was at the bar before I went to the court, and after having served for 10 years on the court, I can only confirm that my previously held views were right, but most parenting cases are won and lost on attitude.
Okay, yeah.
Parental attitude, basically on parental attitude towards the other parent. Each parent's attitude towards the other parent and the other parent's role in the children's lives. I think, I can't really divert from stressing that parenting cases are usually won or lost on the judge's ultimate thoughts about how these parents feel about each other and how they relate to each other and how they will further the other parent's role as a parent in the lives of the children. And it's critical in an international relocation case. So ultimately most international relocation cases are determined, because the law is, of course, that there's the party who's seeking to relocate isn't bound to come up with a compelling reason.
Yeah, that's right.
They aren't working on a status quo that the children's best interests are served by staying here, and therefore they're only to be allowed to go if the other party demonstrates a really compelling reason. But ultimately they will be determined, in my experience, on the basis of whether or not the parent who wants to go is likely to be able to realistically and practically be able to further the relationship, you know, foster, promote, encourage the relationship between the children who go with them, if she goes or he goes, and the parent who stays behind back in the country where they're going from.
All I was going to just ask, just in terms of the issue of, you know, not having to provide a compelling reason, I mean, that's the law, but I'm really interested to know, as someone who's determined these cases, when has there ever been a situation where you've determined a case and even though they're not required to give a compelling reason, someone hasn't given a compelling reason? Like, you think you're not required to, but surely people are throwing out as much as they can to say, you know, this is why I'm seeking to do this before a court. Like, it seems a bit, you know, crazy that there wouldn't be some compelling reasons thrown in the evidence at some point.
Yeah, look, I suppose the best way to answer that is by saying everyone who comes with an international relocation case, international relocation application, generally has a reason for wanting to relocate to the other country. Like I just said to you, it's either, well, they're so often they are because that's where they came from originally before they came to Australia. They still have family back there, friends, support. So often it's the applicant is a mother who has come out here and had left family and friends and all forms of support behind. And sometimes their English ability is not great. And they come here and they have a separation and they're left without realistic support, much support at all. It's hard to say that in those circumstances that person wanting to return to their home, former home and their supports is not compelling.
Yeah.
Alternatively, they will have met a new partner and that partner has an employment reason or their own reason that they don't actually, they're not an Australian citizen or, you know, they never lived here permanently. They don't have permanent residency and they have to go back to their country. And, you know, so those reasons as generally given are, it's hard to say that they're not in themselves compelling.
Yeah.
But then you think about as well, being the decision maker in this kind of case, is it must weigh heavily on your mind in circumstances where an order permitting the children to relocate has significant consequences for their welfare and development in the future, where they're going to be, what they're going to do, their friendships, their attachments, their relationships. It's an enormous undertaking by the court to make those kinds of decisions.
Mm. Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It's two of the hardest types of cases that family court judges have to decide, and I lost count. I couldn't count them on my fingers and toes, the number of these sorts of cases that I had to decide. I think three out of the last four judgments that I had delivered before I retired or resigned from the court were international relocations. Mm. But so international relocations, as I say, because the interests of both sides are usually legitimate and understandable. And the other really difficult cases, of course, are those that are a little bit under scrutiny right at the moment because there's been a recent report released and I think it's going to be discussed online later this week or early next week by the authors of the report about sexual abuse cases.
Yeah.
Where one parent alleges that the other parent has either perpetrated or acquiesced in sexual abuse of children. They're the two hardest forms of cases to decide as family court judges, I think. And because understandably, because of the consequences one way or the other for the children, and what weighs heavily on a family court judge's mind is because of the consequences, particularly for children, if you get the decision wrong.
The other, I guess, thing that flows from that decision-making process in an international relocation matter is, again, I'm sort of asking you to provide statistical know-how, which I won't hold you to, but how regularly do you think international relocation cases are actually appealed? Because, you know, someone's going to be quite unhappy with the outcome, and that's not a reason to appeal, but you can imagine that people can find reasons to appeal. Did you find when you were on the bench that, you know, when you were making those decisions, there was more frequency in people appealing those kinds of decisions, or it was just, similar to other cases?
My own personal experience was I can't even immediately think of an international relocation case that was appealed, just as distinct from Hague Convention matters, which are different. Yep. But I honestly can't remember any at the moment. That's not to say that I didn't have any of my decisions in international relocation matters appealed, but I would certainly recall if it was a regular thing.
Yeah.
I think the appeals were far more common from the sexual abuse cases, the unacceptable risk cases. They were far more common. But that's not to say that international relocation cases aren't appealed, because they are, and some of them go all the way to the High Court. And
of course.
Yeah.
But so, I guess the decision makers are also going to be pretty cautious and considered about their reasons for judgment as well. So, you know, maybe it's just it's a tricky set of circumstances.
Yeah, I think there was a recent one. There was a recent full court appeal judgment handed down in Brisbane from a decision, interestingly, from a judge who's now a Div 2 judge, an FCC judge, which is interesting that, with all due respect to his honour, he obviously decided to hear it and determine it without transferring it up to division to the family court. But it was appealed and successfully appealed to being sent back for a rehearing. So there's a fairly recent full court decision on it. So I can't remember the name of the matter or how recent, but it was within the last month or so. Yeah.
So when we talk about international relocation or domestic relocation, we're talking about someone who's asking for permission to relocate. There's a, you know, there's a question there in relation to permission or consent to move.
Yeah.
Moving and thinking about Hague Convention matters, that's obviously as a result of someone unilaterally making a decision and, you know, returning to another country or going home or doing whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. There was a case that came out of your court back in 2011, which is commonly coined the Italian girls case.
Yeah, well, I actually call it the Italian sisters case.
Italian sisters case. That was a matter that achieved worldwide press. You know, it was around the world. Your name, particularly as the judicial officer who decided that case. And the question that I have is, now we're 10 years on from that decision, looking back now and thinking about the hype and everything that went on around that case, do you look at it differently as to what it was at the time? Or
What I can tell you is the way I look at it differently now is that I'm even more confident and satisfied that I made the right decision.
The full court agreed.
The full court agreed. The High Court agreed. Yeah, I was actually, if you recall, I was actually made a defendant.
That's right, you were.
A respondent to
the High Court application.
Yeah, to an application for prerogative writs. I was successful.
You were very successful.
In the High Court, if you'd like to call it, if you'd like to describe it that way. Yeah, but. I've heard and seen and read stories about the girls back in Italy. The youngest one now be close to being an adult, but the two older ones, at least, if not the three older ones, I'd say, are all young women now. Mm-hmm. And the two older ones be close to 30. They've been in their late 20s. And from all reports, they were happy to be back in Italy and, had formed relationships and settled back into their life as young Italian women. So I have absolutely no regrets about that case whatsoever. And believe that I decided it according to law and according to my oath without fear or favour, and did what I thought was right, even though it was difficult. It was my first year on the bench when I first heard that case.
Wow.
Again, wow. Sadly for the mother who was the respondent in the Hague application before me, sadly she was unrepresented on the day. You see, so I'd like to actually hear, you know, put in a bit of a plug for greater resources to be directed towards legal aid and legal aid assistance to litigants in family law matters and especially in Hague matters. But I, as I said to you before, the numbers of cases that are being heard in which there were litigants unrepresented, both sides, was increasing all the time over the last few years. And principally, I mean, some litigants ultimately make the decision to represent themselves, perhaps having been through four or five sets of solicitors and ultimately convinced, albeit perhaps in a misguided fashion, that they can do a better job representing themselves than they could, than any lawyer could. But most of the litigants who represent themselves do so because of financial impediments, financial impecuniosity. And if we had better legal aid funding and they had legal representation, then a lot of those 1,800 matters that were called over at the winter callover wouldn't have been there. They'd have been out of the system by now. So it's all cost-benefit analysis exercise, I suppose.
It's true. It's true. Thinking about what that is in a Hague Convention matter, they are rare. They are quite rare. And a lot of people don't really know how they start or how things happen because it's not the traditional approach to commencing a proceeding or doing all sorts of things. Mm. Can you talk people through just what a Hague Convention is? Because it's first you approach your central authority, isn't it? And in Australia, that's the Attorney General's Department if you've had a child taken away or...
Well, basically... the family court in Australia only deals with the applications that are brought here in front of it by our central authority, right? Mm-hmm. So what has happened in the lead up to an application being made in the Australian court by the central authority or on behalf of the central authority is that a parent has moved to Australia with a child or children and has come here either to stay permanently or has come here on a holiday and decided to stay permanently, and the other parent who has either gone home from that holiday or was always back in the country of origin, who realises that the parent has gone and taken the children to Australia or has stayed in Australia with the children after a holiday, which was the Italian sister's case, then immediately goes off. Presumably they go off to lawyers or they look on the internet and find out that they go to something in their own country. If it's a convention country, they go to to the central authority, which is some office or authority within their own government, and they make the complaint. And so the central authority of their country then transmits an application on their behalf to our central authority in Canberra. And when I was on the court, the central authority in Canberra would then transmit it to the Child Welfare Department by whatever name it was going by at the time in Queensland, and they would run the application on behalf of the central authority. So they then apply to the court fairly quickly after, sometimes before they've even found where the parent is with the child or children, before they've even served them. And sometimes they'll come along ex parte and get orders, ex parte orders, restraining the parent here from leaving and ordering them to deliver up passports, etc. And then the matter gets, well, if they haven't been served, that it just gets adjourned until they are served, but then it gets set down for a directions hearing. And they come along and generally a standard set of directions are made and it gets listed for trial fairly quickly because there's an obligation on Australia under the convention to hear matters expeditiously, and that obligation then is imposed effectively on the family court to act expeditiously to at least meet Australia's obligations to hear and determine quickly. So they come on fairly quickly. I understand now since I left the court, or just before I left the court, it's been somehow centralised through Melbourne, through a particular judge of the family court, or now Division One in Melbourne, who is doing most of the preliminary work and then farming them out, or, you know, passing the matters off to particular judges around the country to hear and to actually hear the trials or the hearings of the Hague applications. So that's what I understand has happened.
And look, I think your point before about, you know, greater representation in general through legal aid and funding through legal aid, but particularly in these kinds of cases for respondents, is a really valid one, because it's really easy to say, look, it's a jurisdictional hearing, so, you know, it's about, you know, like, do they have a right to be, where do they fall under the convention? But there are some complexities to that jurisdictional issue in terms of things like, and I think it's, you know, the wording is, are they exercising rights of custody, time limits, and obviously, you know, the
habitual residence. Habitual residence. The determination of the child's habitual residence. They have to have been habitually resident in the country that they came from at the time that they were brought from there. Mm.
And, you know, wrongful retention and so forth. But, you know, they are kind of complex legal questions that self-represented litigants who, you know, potentially have done the wrong thing, and there's a punitive element, I think, to these kinds of cases in a sense, because, you know, there's this presumption that we're just dealing with jurisdiction because you've potentially done the wrong thing. But they, you know, it's the kind of legal questions that you think people really should have proper representation in assisting them through.
Yeah, absolutely. They're definitely not best interests determinations. They are simply matters, you know, where you have to determine them and decide them on the law, applying the facts to the, or applying the law to the particular facts in the case. But, you know, questions such as consent, acquiescence as well, those sorts of things. And
that was a central feature to the Italian sisters case.
It was one of the central features, absolutely. Yep. The question of whether he'd consented to her coming here permanently or not, and then whether he had acquiesced in it after it had happened. So, yeah, they were central features. So, you know, I can say that really the mother in that case, who goes by the anonymised name of Garning, I think you might
That's
have
right, reminded Garning.
Me of Garning. Ms. Garning really didn't represent herself very well in respect of being able to put her best foot forward in arguing a case for us being able to stay here. So she was represented each other time that it came back, well, when it went on appeal, and then when it went to the High Court, and it came back before me again a year later on another application for me to set aside the original return order. She was represented by Dr. Jacoba Brash on that occasion, who's now the head of the Law Council of Australia. So she had good representation. She had Silk Graham Page, QC, representing her at one point. So she was well represented after that. But the critical time was when the hearing was, at which I determined all the factual findings, the relevant factual findings, which then stuck, you know, as they do. She was unrepresented. So, yeah, that's why I say she'd have been much better off had she been legally represented.
And I think in that case particularly as well, there are a couple of lessons there for us as practitioners, which I think, you know, sometimes we need to brush up and remember on. The rule in Jones and Dunkel was a big consideration in that case in terms of the evidence of consent and, you know, thinking about what evidence do you adduce in your case, what are the facts you're looking to prove, and what evidence do you need to put before the court to assist the judge in making a determination. Mm. And in that case particularly, the mother's case fell down on those issues.
Yeah, and the central authority was able to present a fair bit of evidence that rebutted the mother's argument that the father had consented to her coming. You see, if you remember the facts in that case, the father originally would never consent to the four girls being issued with passports.
That's right.
Australian passports, because she was an Australian woman. If you remember, she'd gone over as a very young woman as an exchange student to Florence. And
fell in love.
Yeah, she fell in love with the host brother and stayed and married him and had these four daughters with him. But she repeatedly was asking him for his consent to her getting Australian passports for the girls, presumably Italian ones as well. Maybe he was hanging on to those, but she wanted Australian passports and she kept telling him she wanted to be able to bring them here for a holiday. And eventually she met with him at a cafe and she was able to persuade him to sign the applications for passports on the basis that she was only going to come for a holiday. And part of that persuasion was she showed him she'd bought return tickets.
That's right.
Return tickets. So, you know, which suggests, oh yeah, we're going to be coming back. And so he ultimately, reluctantly and in with worry, I was satisfied, did agree to them coming. And then it was only...
But there was a friend there watching at the signing, wasn't it? At the signing...
I think that might be right. Yeah, I think that's probably right. Yeah, yeah. And that's right, the mother was saying at trial, I think, oh, well, I've got a friend who could give evidence, but she was never, that's your point, you know, she never adduced any evidence from that particular friend.
And the same issue on the tickets, because her family in Australia bought return tickets.
Yeah.
And her evidence was that it was cheaper for them to do that as opposed to buying one-way tickets, but she didn't adduce evidence from the family members that purchased the tickets.
No, you're right. That's right. She didn't adduce any evidence to persuade me that that was actually the case, apart from it being a bald assertion from the bar table in court. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so anyway, the other thing that hurt her was that there was an article in the local Sunshine Coast newspaper.
That's right.
Where she boasted about having to effectively trick him into signing the passports. That was all before the Hague application was brought. And
what'd she say, Your Honour? No, they've misquoted me. They misquoted me.
That's right, she did. That's exactly the case she ran on. She was unable to adduce evidence that satisfied me that they'd misquoted it, put it that way. Yeah,
this is where it's perilous how your clients communicate, generally on social media or by text message, sometimes in the local newspaper, and sometimes you can square them away and say, look, this is what we need to do, don't say these things. Sometimes the horse is already bolted by the time the case gets to court. So
you know what I was telling you, it brings me back to attitude, right? So many former couples who are parents of children demonstrate their attitude to each other and about the other parent on social media.
Yeah.
Right? Without ever giving a second thought to the idea that they might appear in court one day and that the social media posts that they're responsible for might be being considered by a judge. And, you know, so much is shown about attitude by those documents and, you know, all one can say to a client as soon as they walk in the door is stop, cease and desist from posting anything on social media about that's negative about your other partner, about your former partner, about the children.
I've been in court before with a self-represented litigant on the other side who was tweeting live from the courtroom.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I think we were in court together.
That wasn't bad. I think we were
about
together.
About the judge we were in court.
About the judge we were in court.
Yeah. Well, I certainly had a matter. I had a Hague matter where a friend of the respondent, it was a New Zealand case where they were from New Zealand, the friend was recording in the back of the court, recording the, you know, the whole proceedings, and I don't know what that was for.
Oh, recording on their mobile phone?
Yeah, yeah.
You're joking.
I think judges are clever enough to know that lawyers can put together really good affidavit material on behalf of their clients. But
that's what they get paid for. That's right.
We can polish it.
But text messages are the window into the souls of our clients and how they really communicate. And, you know, you think sometimes there's nothing you can do to save how people have been communicating. And sometimes even after you say, stop communicating like that, they still do it and they're like, oh, sorry, had a slip up. And you think it's not a slip up.
I had so many of the cases, the parenting cases I had to hear and determine, there were pages and pages and pages of emails that had been, you know, email strings that were downloaded and given to me, pages of text messages, pages. I had an amazing case, a Chinese case. When I say Chinese, all the parties were Chinese and hadn't been in Australia very long. And it was about property. It wasn't about, well, it was originally about children, but that got sorted, and then it became about property. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the Chinese app, communications app, but it's called WeChat.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's the equivalent of WhatsApp. And interestingly, I'm studying part-time at the moment. I'm doing international relations. And next week, I'm doing foreign policy and diplomacy at the moment. And next week, we're learning about China's soft power. And I was just reading an article this very morning where the article was talking about WeChat. And the Chinese government monitors, very closely monitors Chinese people's use of WeChat.
Wow.
And I wonder what
I didn't know that.
But in this particular case, the wife had obtained the husband's phone, the ex-husband's phone, and she'd been able to download, you know, 3 months' worth of WeChat communication between him and his new partner.
Oh, no.
Who he was having an extramarital affair with, which he denied. And she was able to then translate, get these WeChat pages translated and put into evidence before me. And even up to the date of the trial, the husband and his former partner denied that they were their communications and said that she'd just somehow been able to manufacture it all, which was a very silly denial, I thought, without being able to adduce any evidence to prove that that was the case. But in the witness box, the woman he was having the affair with, after a little bit of gentle questioning from me, broke down and admitted that it was, that she was lying, and that I think she actually wanted to say in front of the husband and his former wife in court, I think she wanted to claim the affair, you know, claim ownership of the affair. I think she wanted to let the wife know that, yes, I was in an affair with him and now he's mine, you know.
So oh, my goodness.
She broke down and admitted to it and accepted that it was all true and that everything they'd said about the WeChats were false. So, but you know, I probably had a centimetre thick worth of WeChat documents. So that's what I say. Every parent out there who's on their mobile phones or their computers sending emails or texts or posting social media posts, they have to realise, I always say it, tell everyone, it's the test. The test that you should apply just before you push the button that says post or just before you push the button that says send. You always have to hold your finger up for a few seconds and say, how would I feel if I was to read this on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald or the Courier Mail? Or, you know, how would I feel if I saw this if in an affidavit that a judge was going to read in a case next year? You know, so more people should do that, and there'd be a lot less crap, if I can use that expression, being posted on social media, and a lot more respectful communication, emails and texts between parents.
And then going back to your point before as well, you know, you're talking about receiving volumes of material when you are conducting a case, doing all the different bits and pieces. Mm. As a judge, how do you digest the enormous amount of material that is presented to you, you know, tender bundles that are volumes thick of different things?
Well, I had my own personal practice of saying to the lawyers at the start, you know, when I get handed volumes like that, I'd just simply say, well, take it from me, I won't read them as a matter of course. You'll either have to effectively take me to them during the process of cross-examination if you're relying on them, you know, to somehow discredit the other side or bolster your case in cross-examination.
Yeah.
Or during your submissions at the end, you're going to have to refer to them.
Yeah.
And otherwise, don't expect me to be reading through thousands of pages of documents simply because you attach them to an affidavit.
Yeah,
so you just say, just take me to the juiciest bits and we'll go from there.
Yeah. Yep. And realistically, there's only a couple of really juicy pages out of the thousands. Juicy translates to relevant and cogent, you know, and persuasively important, you know, in the case.
Coming back to what's fun as well about, you know, when you said in the WeChat case, the partner wanted to kind of own it. The other thing that's really fun with text messages is when you know there's some bad text messages there, but the client's in the witness box and they decide to own it as well. And they're like, yeah, I did say that and I stand behind it. And you think it's going to crucify your case, but okay. And, you know, people do that.
That's when you see their counsel. If the counsel is a good good barrister and their solicitor, if they're competent and experienced and knowledgeable, that's when you see them start to cringe. And that's the real test of the old poker face from the advocate, you know, because sometimes their own barristers and solicitors just can't help themselves but cringe, and you see them shrinking down into a ball at the bar table, thinking to themselves, there goes our case.
Yeah, you've got to just look ahead and not make eye contact with anyone at that point.
Again, it goes to attitude, doesn't it? That witness is demonstrating attitude. If they say, "Yeah, I said that, and I don't resile from it. I stand by it." Well, that's demonstrating attitude.
As I always tell my clients, the judge sees everything in the courtroom. They see everything.
Judges' jobs in parenting cases, the judge's task is predictive, right? It's a discretionary process, but it's predictive. You've got to try and predict what's going to happen in the future in this, you know, here.
It's interesting.
I've got to make these orders to account for this. So, and I always used to say, it's true, the best, it's a common phrase, you know, the best indicator of what's going to happen in the future is the past.
No, that's right.
The best indicator of future behaviour of litigants is their past behaviour. That's why I urge all the young solicitors who are listening to this, family law solicitors, from the moment a client makes contact with them, they have to take responsibility for, you know, advising that client and helping that client shape that attitude that is ultimately going to convince a judge this is why this particular client should either, you know, retain residence of the children or have sole parental responsibility or see them from Thursday night till Tuesday morning. You know, it's all about attitude, and solicitor's job is as much helping the client by helping shape that attitude if it's poor in the first place or needs a bit of work, as it is in drawing their affidavits and putting their applications in on time.
Can I say that's actually a really interesting observation, because I think prior to reporting this podcast, I mentioned to you that we recorded with Dr. Catherine Boland, who's a clinical psychologist in family law matters and does single expert reports and all sorts of different things.
Yeah, she was a witness in some cases, particularly a couple I heard in Sydney.
She is incredible and formidable. Yeah, but one comment she made...
In an international relocation when I allowed a mother and child to return to France way back in 2012 or something, she was the single expert in the case.
She's brilliant. She really is. And in that podcast, we asked her, we said, what can we do as lawyers to assist our clients, or tools or strategies we can use to minimize conflict and, you know, get the show moving? And her comment was, I think, something that everybody needs to hear, but it aligns with what you've just said, in that lawyers need to be the role models for good behavior in the conduct of their matters.
Absolutely. And that comes, you know, that even goes down to the sort of letters they write.
That's right. And don't send it at 5 o'clock on a Friday.
No. It's amazing that you say that. The number of solicitors who I've heard complaints from over the years about other solicitors sending through, you know, a 4 or 5 page letter and letters with demands in them at 5 o'clock or later on a Friday afternoon is extraordinary. And some of them expect responses that same day, or, you know, some of the letters at 4:45 say we want your client's response by 5 o'clock. You know,
worse is, and I complained to Tim about this recently, you know, when you get demands by way of fax, or sorry, not fax, no one faxes anymore, but by email, where they're like, you know, here's our demands and we want an answer by 6:30 tonight. And you think it's Friday night. What's going on?
But they haven't written for 3 weeks.
That's right.
They write and say, this is really urgent. We've got to have your response by 12 o'clock tomorrow or 6 o'clock tonight or whatever. It's just, it's ridiculous. So, again, I say it's a bit like the post, the social media post. For solicitors, when you write a letter to another solicitor about a matter in family law, you should write it with complete knowledge and understanding and belief that one day it might be on a judge's bench in front of him or her in a trial being read by a judge. And it's got to pass the test of, was that a reasonable response, or was that a reasonable position? Was it decent, reasonable, professional, ethical, sensible? You know, your letter always should pass that test, because, you know, I'm not urging people, solicitors, to put all their letters into evidence. And you can, whenever you're writing an affidavit, you can always say, oh, I wrote, you know, on such and such a day, I wrote and raised this issue. You don't need to say, exhibited here too is a copy of the letter. You only need to put it into evidence if the other side disputes the content of your paragraph that says, I wrote and raised this issue, you know. So I don't urge, because the bane of a judge's existence is reading, you know, all these letters that solicitors say, oh, I exhibit the copy of the letter, and then the next paragraph, I exhibit a copy of the next letter. Judges don't need to see them all. They just need to know what the key, you know, in the cases where it matters, they just need to know, you know, I wrote a letter and said something about this and they didn't respond, or they did and they said something in response. You don't need to put all the letters in, but you should be writing the letters as if you may have to put them in. And you want the other thing I always say to solicitors and to litigants, I've always said it when I was at the bar and still say it now after 10 years on the court, you want to get – cases are not just about attitude, but they're about – and well, it's part – attitude is part of the same thing. You want – cases are won by the parent who gains and holds the high ground, the high moral ground. You know? And high moral ground is all about attitude too, you know, if showing – and having and displaying the good attitude to the other parent. That's how you hold them high moral ground. So, you know, you've got to write a letter as if you're trying to gain and hold the high moral ground. It's exactly the same thing.
And look, there are positive flow-on effects from that in terms of being able to, you know, keep the chain of communication open between you and your colleagues in resolving a matter. But also, if you look to the very explicit communication from our new court through the court merger, I think there's an expectation that we're going to be held to higher accountability in terms of the way we communicate and conduct matters, because certainly, you know, our practice directions and so forth seem to be very explicit about expecting lawyers to support a litigation process in a really positive way rather than in a very acrimonious and adversarial way.
It's interesting you raise that and talk about held to account, Gillian, because one could say the same could be said of the court. Mm. If it doesn't meet its target of or its goal of hearing and determining cases in within 12 months,
true,
hold them to account, I say.
Yeah.
Hold them to account. Well, not so much the court. I don't like to put all the responsibility for that on the court. After all, resourcing the courts and the circumstances that have led to the courts being where they are at the moment is a government issue. It's a government problem.
Yeah.
Resourcing the courts is something the government's responsible for, and the fact that the family and federal circuit courts haven't been appropriately resourced over the last decade or so falls at the feet of executive government, no one else, not the family court itself.
It's going to be very interesting to see where it happens. Over the next 12 months, I think it's a brave new world.
You can bet, Tim, that I'll be watching it carefully.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll all be setting our clock watches and seeing that, you know, international relocation cases get dealt with within 12 months, which would be amazing as well, like litigants.
I had a solicitor ring me yesterday asking me for a bit of advice about an international relocation, and I said, and after he told me a little bit about the facts, I said, there's no way that the parent who wants to go back overseas with the child is going to get the permission of the other parent on the basis of the fact I was told there was camera surveillance and everything, you know. So
no
way that parent's going to get permission. In my experience, on my time on the court, it'd be a year to 2 years before that matter gets to a final hearing in the family court. So you need to file tomorrow or as soon as to get the process started. I said, fortunately for your client, the new court in which you will be filing, Div 2 of what do they call it, FCFCOA or something or other?
Yeah, it's convoluted. It's too difficult.
The new court is promising hearing and determining within 12 months. I said, good luck, and you can rely on that. You've got every reason to rely on that commitment and try to hold them to it.
And tell him to call you back in September last year and say, has she gone yet? Have you got your final orders?
Well, I know him, so I'll keep asking him along the way, how's it going? Where is it now? Are you close to trial? So we'll see.
Look, maybe it could even get into that spicy quick trial list or whatever it's – what's it called, Tim?
Fast track list.
You know, who knows?
Is there a fast track list, is there?
Yep. We're suddenly the most dynamic jurisdiction in Australia. But anyway.
Every solicitor will be trying to work out a way to make
that. That's right.
To get into the fast track list.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, thank you very much for your time today. That's been – firstly, really informative, but secondly, quite fun. We knew you were going to be great to talk to because Tim, I think I've told you, is from Tamworth and so are you originally. So, you know, there's a certain synergy there. We're pro Tamworth, even though I'm from Newcastle. But
it's only just up the road.
That's right.
It's only just up the road. We're great people, obviously. But thanks for making the time today.
And we'll see you at the Country Music Festival in January next
year. That's right. I've been to a few of those and they are a lot of fun.
They are a lot of fun.
Everyone. I encourage everyone who hasn't been to one of the country music festivals in Tamworth in January to go to one sometime in their life and don't necessarily wait till you become a grey nomad.
That's right. I think it's
half
great.
The people who go are grey nomads, of course. But I should have been able to tell Tim was from Tamworth because people from Tamworth have these characteristic grins. And
really?
Cheeky.
My brothers and I are always joking about the Tamworth grin. So
there you go.
You carry it very well, Tim. So
thank you very much.
Yeah, you probably weren't even born when I left Tamworth in 1978.
I was born 1990.
Well, there you go. Your parents were lucky to have been born when I left Tamworth.
Thank you so much for today, Colin. We're very grateful for your time and your company today. It's been fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah. That's all right. Wish all of family law practitioners who might be listening to this podcast all the best. Keep their chins up through COVID and keep working hard. Family law is a great area of humanity to work in, and I wish everyone the best in it.
See you all again sometime
around the traps.
Yep. See you soon. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast. With Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend. To find out more about your hosts and what they do, visit chamberlains.com.au. And now, here's the bit the boss insisted we say. The information in this podcast is for general educational purposes only. None of the content should be considered legal advice. Please don't make decisions based on the information in this podcast without seeking professional legal advice of your own. For more information, visit chamberlains.com.au.